So, good morning. As she said, my name is Christy Fuggio. I'm the Asylum Program Director at Physicians for Human Rights. And this morning, I'd like to talk to you about our experience mobilizing health professionals to assist with our advocacy efforts on immigration detention reform. Let me give you a little bit of background, actually, on the asylum program before I get started. Our asylum program includes a network of over 400 dedicated health professionals who provide physical and psychological evaluations in support of asylum and other immigration applications. These medical evaluations document the physical and psychological suffering that people have experienced in other countries and are often the strongest support that they can provide in the immigration application system. Let me give you a brief outline of where I'm going with my discussion today. First, I'll give an outline on the immigration detention background and why we decided to engage health professionals in our advocacy efforts surrounding reform efforts of the system. Next, I'll talk about obstacles we faced in engaging health professionals and some ongoing projects that we have them engaged in right now. And finally, I'll share some of the best practices that we've learned and the results that we've achieved over the past 10 months. I should start by saying that we just began this program. The asylum program has been in existence for over 20 years, but these new advocacy efforts, strongly engaging health professionals, just started in January of this year. So the immigration detention system, some of you may know, is a huge, sprawling system. The scope of it is really unbelievable. Incarceration in this country, as you know, is huge and growing all the time, and the same may be said of the immigration detention system. There are over 250 facilities across the country, and it's a combination of three different types of facilities. There are government-owned and operated facilities, private contract facilities, and then simple jails and prisons that are housing other kinds of criminals are also housing immigration detainees. The system affects over 400,000 people each year. The reason that it affects so many people is that we have a congressional mandate that there be 33,400 beds available each night. That also explains why, in addition to the regular detention centers, why there's also just this random scattering of people being housed in regular local and county jails. The government is basically renting space from there so that they have beds to put people in every night. The cost of the system is huge. It costs roughly $100 per person per night, so the government is spending more than $3 million daily to maintain this system. Most critically from our perspective is that 113 people have died in the system since 2003. And the reason we date statistics back to 2003 is because that's the time when the system broke from the old Immigration and Naturalization Services and new agencies were created, namely Department of Homeland Security, under which the immigration detention system is run. This model is what we call detain for deportation. That means that the focus is basically on keeping people healthy, just healthy enough so that they can be deported as soon as they're ready. There's no mandate or intention to maintain or restore health of the people being held in immigration detention. The system is focused primarily on acute care, again, to address any really serious issues so that as soon as their case has gone through the administrative process, and if the order is in fact deportation, that they can just be put on a plane and sent home. There's a lack of attention to chronic conditions, so people suffering from things like asthma, hypertension, diabetes, even AIDS, have a really difficult time receiving timely and quality services, as well as medication for their conditions. In addition to these medical concerns, we have structural concerns. One is that security is prevalent. Even though it's meant to be administrative detention, it is not meant to be punitive detention. DHS rules it, rather with an iron hand. Shackles are overused, solitary confinement is overused, use of psychotropic drugs to, induce people into, compliant moods is also used far too often. Additionally, the system is marked by a lack of transparency and accountability. The roles of the health professionals in the system is ambiguous. The detainees are often not sure whether they're really going to serve their best interests or whether they're operating, for security personnel. In addition, there are multiple chains of command in the system. So there's the security chains of command, doctor chains of command, nurses chains of command. There's not enough communication across that. Across each chain of command, there's not an integrated management structure. So there are, the conditions are ripe for a lot of human rights violations and a lot of denial of critical health care for people. This quote that I've provided at the bottom comes from the Division of Immigration Health Services website. Now, DIHS is an agency that's ostensibly responsible for provision of health care to the immigration detainees, but it is an agency under Department of Homeland Security. And you can see from the mission statement that they're providing the health care and public health services in support of immigration law enforcement. That is their main mission statement. It's across their website, and it is, in fact, the way that they operate. The population being held in immigration detention is an extremely vulnerable population. Many are survivors of human rights abuses, both physical and psychological, including torture, domestic violence, and all sorts of human rights abuses. Many have advanced medical needs. These needs may be related to the trauma that they have suffered. They are also can be related to the difficulties they endured on the journey over to the United States. Many also may have not had access to health care either in their country of origin or in the United States since arriving here. Chronic conditions and mental disabilities are also prevalent. Unbelievably enough, there's no government tracking of the number of people that have chronic conditions, no tracking of the number of people that have any sort of mental disabilities. So you can imagine how can they have the resources to care for these people when they don't even know what the percentage is. NGOs estimate that the number of people with mental disabilities is around 15%, but it's just an estimate, and the government is not even making an attempt to try and track those numbers. So the biggest problem that we see, given that this is a vulnerable population with many different health concerns, is that the intake screenings that are done at detention centers are rather inadequate. They're supposed to occur as soon as someone is brought into immigration detention. That often doesn't happen. There can be a delay of several days or sometimes even weeks. The screenings are often only a few minutes with just a short battery of questions. And unfortunately, the screenings are often not even done by health professionals at all, but they're done by security personnel. So the problem, of course, is that if there are no statistics on what sorts of problems people are suffering from, the intake screenings are insufficient, so it's not even identified who needs what sort of services. So the whole system is really, inadequate is rather inadequate a word to describe how poorly the system is working. So next, I'd like to talk about why engage health professionals as advocates. And there's no need to go into too much detail. It's mostly obvious, I think. Health professionals work from direct experience. The health professionals that we use for our advocacy, we draw primarily from our asylum network. So these are people who have done a lot of medical evaluations for people who have been in detention, who have suffered human rights abuses. Many of them have been in detention centers multiple times to do the evaluations, so they know what they're talking about. And of course, smart policymakers recognize the value of this experience and the expertise, and they like to include it in their recommendations and their policy formulations. Another part of our advocacy is raising public awareness. So the public respect that people have for health professionals is very important. Their opinions carry much more weight. And although as an attorney, I'm loath to admit it, but the arguments advanced by health professionals are much more credible to people than any arguments advanced by attorneys or other people. They're simply based on scientific fact, and people find them to be less full of rhetoric and more credible. And finally, health professionals are already, many of them already, thought leaders and private advocates on health and human rights through the work that they do in their clinical settings. They work one-on-one with patients, with regular patients like all of us, or also specifically with people who have mental disabilities, who have suffered human rights abuses. So they're already working on health and human rights issues at the micro level. So moving them up to the bigger stage, the advocacy stage in DC, up to the macro level, is actually not as huge a leap as it might seem. There are some obstacles to mobilizing health professionals, of course. Busy schedules, like everyone has. The people that we're using for our advocacy, most of them already have full-time jobs, so the time that they give to us is strictly voluntary. It's in their quote-unquote spare time. So, that's always that we would always like them to do more, but we have to be respectful of their time constraints as well. Many have self-doubt about their expertise and their skills. They may feel great about their clinical skills, but they wonder if what they have clinically is enough to bring to the advocacy stage. They may also have doubts about their ability, their communication skills. They may not feel they're a great writer or a great, you know, speech maker, and they may doubt their ability to communicate their ideas and recommendations effectively to policymakers. More significantly, I think there's a real lack of understanding about government processes, the advocacy process, and also doubts about the effectiveness of advocacy in general. Some people may have written their congressperson, called their congressperson, tried to do, you know, different kinds of small, you know, minor or advocacy efforts, and they may have felt that they were not heard, that they were ignored, or just that these efforts were going nowhere. So we do work with them to kind of reassure them that there is a real process at work and that the policymakers actually do respect a lot of the ideas that come from the advocates and the health professionals working with them. Finally, we need to be aware of potential political concerns always. PHR's agenda is generally fairly liberal, but we have to be aware that not all the health professionals we work with are as liberal as we are, and they might not all be completely on board with the ideas we'd like to advance. So we try and engage them as much as we can, you know, to the extent that they're comfortable politically with the ideas that we're putting on our agenda. Right now, we have a number of different projects going on. I'm not sure if I mentioned that this project started in January of this year. So we tried to get it ramped up as quickly as possible. We have a full-time advocacy person working for PHR in DC, and her job is really to engage the health professionals deeply, to find the opportunities for advocacy, and to get people excited about it. So the main, the deepest advocacy effort we have going on right now is this medical working group discussion series that's going on with Department of Homeland Security and some of our colleague NGOs. And this is a great opportunity for health professionals who have the flexibility in their schedules, time to travel to DC, and interest in doing a series of face-to-face meetings with Department of Homeland Security. It's a great opportunity because DHS invited us and some other NGOs to participate in this. So I think, you know, a lot of times with advocacy, you're just throwing it out there and seeing what will stick. But in this case, the policymakers at DHS have actually invited us in, so it's a huge opportunity for us and for the health professionals to get their voices and concerns out there. The rest of the things are a number of ways that people can get involved in advocacy, even if they don't have a huge amount of time or a huge amount of flexibility to travel to DC and to do meetings. So these things can all be done from their office, from their home. We can talk to them over the phone about it. We can work over email and through exchanging documents. And all of these are great ways for HPs to get their ideas out there, to comment on draft statements and recommendations that are already in process, to call on Congress to take action, to co-author different letters to editor, op-eds, blog posts, things like that. So I'd like to share with you some of the best practices that we've learned over this last 10 months or so. The first is that we need to always be conscious of our role as an NGO, and that is to be a liaison, an educator, and a mobilizer of the health professionals. They have their clinical expertise, they have their experience working with human rights survivors, working in detention centers. They don't need education on that from us. What they need from us is to be a liaison between them and the policymakers, to make the introductions, to help them understand what different policymakers are responsible for, to educate them about the advocacy process, to help dispel any doubts they have, to mobilize and energize them, and to keep them excited about the opportunities out there for them. Timing is key, of course, to kicking off a new advocacy effort, as well as for each time you want to make asks of health professionals. And that leads to the next one, that is to make strategic and modest requests of the health professionals. We're very careful not to bombard them with requests and to take on different tasks at different times. We try and be respectful of their schedules and ask them to do things only when we see a real policy window, when we see an opportunity to make change. That way they know that we're only going to, you know, sort of bother them or to take their time up when it's something that really counts, something that really matters. We also want to facilitate their participation in advocacy as much as possible, and we can do this in many different ways. If we're asking them to call on their congressperson, we give them the phone numbers. If we're asking them to write a letter to a congressperson, we give them the email addresses or the physical addresses. If we're asking them to co-author something with us, we'll write a draft and give it to them, and they can either sign off on it or they can make edits and revisions, change it however they like. So whatever we can do to make it easier for them to be involved is what we always want to do. Oops, can I go back? Okay. Next is we want to identify and engage health professionals who already have an existing interest and or expertise in the subject matter. As I mentioned before, we're working from our base network of over 400 health professionals. So, you know, right now we've been doing this for less than a year. I definitely don't know all their names, all their clinical expertise, but we are working on getting to the point where we do know all those things. So if we have something, for example, we want to make a push on issues of solitary confinement, we want to reach the point where we can say off the top of our heads, yes, let's call Dr. Smith. She has worked extensively on solitary confinement. She feels passionate about it. She's the right person to give recommendations to DHS about that. We want to listen to their recommendations and incorporate as appropriate. And what I mean by that is we can't take all of everyone's suggestions. Often the health professionals, you know, may be in some conflict themselves about what kind of recommendations we should suggest to Department of Homeland Security. Their ideas may not exactly gel with our agenda. So we want to incorporate them as much as appropriate, but then we also want to let them know, keep the communication channels completely open so they know, yes, we're including this, this is great, we're not going to go this path, and this is why, so that they know and they don't feel that their contributions are minimized or devalued just because we didn't include them in our final proposals. And finally, we want to highlight CV opportunities. This is particularly important when you're engaging younger health professionals. They are building their careers, building their resumes, and it's often a great opportunity for them to be identified as a panelist, an investigator, an advisor to Department of Homeland Security, whatever. So this is a great opportunity to, you know, they're already helping us, and we can help them build their careers as well. Okay, and finally today, I'd like to share with you some of the results that we've achieved over the past 10 months. We've had 80 health professionals engaged in some sort of advocacy, and that can be a range of things. As you saw a few slides back, it could be something simple as much as signing on to a letter, all the way up to co-authoring a medical journal article, to attending the medical working group meetings with Department of Homeland Security. We're seeing a progression from group to solo activities, and that means that some people who started off just signing on to our letters, now they're more interested in doing things on their own, actually going to meetings, actually drafting, you know, some sort of article or op-ed or something like that. We're gratified to see that there's a growing recognition of the expertise of our health professionals as well as our organization in the immigration detention reform field. So we're getting more and more phone calls from our NGO colleagues, from Department of Justice and Department of Homeland Security, asking for advice or asking for us to organize things for them. And finally, three substantive changes or achievements that we've gotten. One is that electronic records are going to be implemented across all the detention centers in the United States. This is a huge, huge win for us. Now, up until now, and still it will go on for several more months, they're using paper records. And, you know, for 250 facilities across the country, when people are transferred very frequently, often in the middle of the night, their records generally don't go with them. They're much delayed if they make it to the next destination at all. So having electronic records implemented will be a wonderful change. The TARS system is also going to be overhauled, and the TARS system is much too complex to get into, but suffice it to say that the current TARS system has resulted in the denial of timely and essential specialized care for many immigration detainees and has resulted in deaths of detainees. So when this system is overhauled, we hope that it will allow immigration detainees to get access to medical services in a much more timely fashion. And finally, we're seeing a growing awareness of mental health issues, the importance of mental health issues, and how it affects immigration detainees. In September, we were asked by Department of Homeland Security and Department of Justice to host an immigration roundtable, a mental health roundtable for all the issues, mental health issues affecting immigration detainees. It was a great opportunity to raise awareness and also to engage our health professionals further, to invite them to come and be panelists to speak at the roundtable. So we're very fortunate that a few weeks ago we received news that from the Langloth Foundation that we've gotten 2 more years of funding. So we look to continue this work. We look to continue this work over the next 2 years to continue to increase the number of health professionals that we have engaged in advocacy. And so I'd like to end the presentation by asking all of you and your colleagues, anyone who's interested in joining our network, in participating in any of these advocacy efforts, please talk to me after the end of the panel. On the back table there, I've left materials from the organization Physicians for Human Rights generally, as well as materials specifically to the Asylum Network. Thank you. So please help yourself to the materials, and please do speak to me if you have any questions or interest in helping out. Thank you.